The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Cindy Fowler from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Dave's Garden. Newsletter from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter from 1001 Hints and Tips for Your Garden by Reader's Digest, and maybe from Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic by Louise Riotes. And we'll start with Dave's Garden e-newsletter. And this is Birds and Bears and the Beechnut Tree by Sharon Brown. The kids at school said there was a bear on my side of the mountain. They said it was on the Virginia side, but they reckoned that the Virginians had run it clear across the mountain, and now they just knew it was on my side. Aunt Bet wanted to go up on the mountain to get some bark from the old beech tree that grew about halfway up. I was a little afraid of going because the kids at school told me about the bear. Aunt Bet said there was no bear and that we would be safe, but I did not know about that. You see, the kids lived above the school and I lived below, and if anything crossed the mountain to my side, they would have seen it first. I believed them. They all swore on their pinkies it was true. And they said they saw it, and it was as tall as a coal truck, and as wide as an outhouse. I told Aunt Bet that those people in Virginia had chased a bear across the mountain, and it was on our side. I told her the kids had seen it. Aunt Bet stopped me mid-sentence when she said, "Ain't nobody seen a bear, 'cause if they did, they wouldn't live to tell about it." She was determined to go up on my side of the mountain to that old beech tree, and I was scared to death. I didn't know who to believe, Aunt Bet or my friends, but I could not let Aunt Bet go up there all by herself. I had to go to keep the bear from getting her. I took a deep breath. "Okay, Aunt Bet, I'll go with you, just so the bear won't eat you." And so we'd started up the mountain. Beech nuts were once a common item on grocery shelves. Dried and roasted, they were a popular substitute for coffee beans, and a beech nut oil was used for cooking. Fagus grandifolia is a Native American tree found from Nova Scotia to Ontario, south to Florida and eastern Texas, and west to Wisconsin and Missouri. It is a medium to large deciduous tree growing to 100 feet or taller. The bark is smooth and light gray with hints of a blue-gray. The leaves are alternate, about 5 inches long with sharp-toothed margins and pointed tips. It blooms in April and May. When mature, the yellowish flowers produce spiny fruit-like structures that open late in summer to expose 2 triangular nuts. In parts of the South, the leaves serve as a pot herb. The raw nut itself is sweet and delicious to eat for humans as well as for squirrels, several birds, and other animals. I wondered if bears liked beech nuts, but I was afraid to say another word about bears to Aunt Bet. Because the beech grows in loamy soils rich in humus, pioneers who spotted it knew they had found good farmland. The one that I remember, the one Aunt Bet and I went to, was fairly high up on the mountainside, but it was located in a naturally flat area that Aunt Bet thought of one time might have been a cornfield. We had never planted anything on it, but I remember there were several places like that on the mountain behind my house. Being a native tree, the beech has enjoyed a long reputation in America as a source of medicines. some Native Americans steeped beech bark in salt water to produce a poison ivy lotion. Beech sap was one ingredient of a syrup compounded to treat tuberculosis in Kentucky. Decoctions of either the leaves or the bark served in folk medicine as an ointment for burns, sores, and ulcers. Internally, it was used as a treatment for bladder, kidney, and liver ailments. Another treatment was using the leaves or roots to cure fevers and diabetes. The oil from the nut was used to treat intestinal worms. The bark and leaves of the beech tree have astringent and antiseptic properties that account for whatever medicinal effect the plant has. Actually, today, the tree is valued more for its wood. It is used in flooring, furniture, crates, and handles for tools. One cautionary word: large doses of nuts may be poisonous to humans and animals alike. Aunt Bet and I got to the beech tree after about a half hour of climbing straight uphill. I was scared to death, but Aunt Bet climbed as if she had not a care in the world. "What will we do if we run into a bear, Aunt Bet? Did you bring something to hit him with?" "I heard tell bears are so big, I'll bet you can't even reach up to his shoulders. Do you think we could climb the beech tree? Can bears climb trees?" Aunt Bet told me to hush up, or I wouldn't have enough energy to left to swat a fly, and certainly not a bear. Whatever we gathered that day, I don't even remember. I was that scared. But once we started down the mountain, Aunt Bet said, "Let me tell you about bears, child. Bears ain't often in these mountains. They live down in the Smokies, and that's pretty far away. And besides, do you hear those birds chirping? Those birds sound real happy. If there was a bear anywhere around us, Virginia or Kentucky, those birds wouldn't be saying a word. They would be so quiet you could hear them breathing. Those birds are not one bit afraid of us, but they sure would be afraid of a bear. Now don't you be worrying about no more bears. Those birds will let us know if a bear is on your side of the mountain." As always, Aunt Bet was right. Now from the National Gardening Association e-newsletter, "Those Pesty Houseplants" by Charlie Nardozzi. When outdoor winter landscape turns drab in most areas of the country, it's nice to have lush tropical houseplants growing indoors to brighten your mood. Keeping houseplants growing well can be a challenge, especially in cold climates. Many have tropical bloodlines. Most grow best in areas with warm temperatures and high humidity, neither of which is in abundance indoors. When a houseplant is struggling in the wrong growing environment, other problems, such as pests, can take over. Insects can thrive on stressed plants, especially where there is a natural lack of predators. Not only are the pests harmful to your plants, the exudates from their feeding can cause damage to rugs, floors, and furniture. Although there are numerous pesticides on the market to control household plant pests, many gardeners are leery of spraying harmful chemicals indoors. Fortunately, there are ways to control the insects without resorting to harmful sprays. The first step is creating a houseplant-friendly environment in your home, imitating the humid tropics. Most foliage houseplants prefer a warm, humid environment. While it's possible to heat your houseplant-filled room to the 70 to 80 degrees range they like, the result will be a drier environment. As temperatures climb above 67 degrees, air humidity levels drop dramatically. Unless you have a humidifier to keep the humidity at the 40 to 50% range, it's better to keep the room on the cool side, 60 to 70 degrees, in winter to keep the humidity higher. However, Do not let the temperature go below 60, since some houseplants, such as African violets and gardenias, may stop flowering and drop leaves. Another way to increase humidity is to group houseplants together and place them on a tray filled with 1 to 2 inches of crushed stones. Keep water in the tray below the bottom of the pots. The water will evaporate and provide humidity. Let there be light. While many houseplants grow as understory plants in subtropical and tropical forests, they require more intense lighting in winter in our temperate climate. Plants not receiving enough light will produce tall, leggy growth and dull, pale leaves. Keep plants growing well by placing them near a sunny window or door, but away from cold drafts. Consider using full-spectrum or halide lights to provide the light intensity and duration plants need. Watering and washing. Periodically washing leaves to remove dust and allowing some air, not cold air, movement around plants will improve plant growth and also reduce the number of insects that call your plants home. Tropicals grow more slowly during these darker months, so they need less water and can become stressed from overwatering, which causes brown leaf tips, leaf drop, and wilting. Plants also need less fertilizer because they are growing more slowly. Excess fertilizer causes succulent growth, a magnet for aphids and other sucking insects. Control strategies. Even if you are meeting the cultural requirements of your houseplants, insects can still be a problem. If you placed your houseplants outdoors in summer, check them for insects before moving them indoors. After the first few weeks indoors, check again for insect eggs that may have hatched. Here are the 6 common houseplant pests and some controls to keep them at bay. When using spray, always test it on a few leaves before spraying the whole plant because some houseplants are sensitive to specific sprays. Aphids. These small, soft-bodied insects may be pale green, pink, black, or yellow. They like to cluster on tips of new growth and leaf undersides, sucking out juices and causing leaves to become distorted and yellow. Aphids secrete a sugary fluid called honeydew that may spur the growth of a sooty black fungus on leaves and cause stickiness on leaves, floors, and rugs. Aphids like fast-growing plants, such as hibiscus. Controls. Place the plant in the shower and knock aphids off the leaves with water, or wash the leaves in a sink full of soapy water. Cut back on high nitrogen fertilizers, which stimulates new growth. For widespread infestations, spray the foliage with insecticidal soap, neem oil, or horticultural oil. Fungus gnats. These small, dark-colored flies jump and fly across the soil surface and around the house. Though they generally don't harm plants, they're a nuisance. The adults lay eggs in potting soil. If numerous enough, the larva can damage plant roots. Controls. Fungus gnats feed on organic matter and fungi in the soil. They especially like moist, rich soil. Let the top layer of the soil dry out between waterings to discourage egg laying. Avoid fish emulsion fertilizers, since they foster the fungus gnats like to eat. Drench the soil with BTI or neem oil to control the larva. Mealybugs. These soft-bodied insects group in white, cottony masses and suck sap from plants. Their feeding weakens the plant and causes leaves to shred. Like aphids, they excrete large amounts of sticky honeydew. Adults tend not to move once settled, while the young, crawlers, can move around the plant. Mealybugs favor cacti and jade plants. Controls. For small infestations, wash the leaves in a shower or dislodge the insects or dab individual mealybugs with a cotton swab doused in rubbing alcohol. The alcohol will desiccate the insects, killing them. For larger infestations, spray with insecticidal soap, neem oil, or horticultural oil. Scale. These insects may be flattened and brown, or thick, white, and covered with a waxy or woolly substance. They appear like small bumps on leaves and stems. Leaves of infested plants turn yellow, and the overall vigor of the plant declines. Like mealybugs, the young are mobile, while the adults tend to settle in one area to feed. Ficus and citrus are often attacked by scale. Controls. Flicking or rubbing the scale off the twigs by hand or dabbing them with rubbing alcohol often controls small infestations. For larger populations, spray horticultural oil or neem oil to cover the shells and suffocate the scale. Scale insects may hang on the twigs and leaves even after they are killed. Spider mites. These small insects aren't usually evident until their population soars and they form their characteristic webbing. Their feeding can cause stippling of the leaves and leaf drop. They thrive in hot, dry conditions and are particularly fond of cyclamen, Norfolk Island pine, and Scheffleria. Controls. Keep plants misted. High humidity discourages the mites from getting established. Wash off infested plants in a shower or sink full of soapy water. Spray insecticidal soap or horticultural oil on severely infested plants. In houses with many plants, consider releasing predatory mites, such as the two-spotted mite. These mites feed on spider mites and reduce the population without harming plants, pets, or people. It will take a few weeks for them to control an infestation. White flies. These tiny white insects feed in large numbers on leaf undersides, sucking out plant juices. They secrete honeydew that may cause the growth of a sooty black fungus on leaves. Their feeding can cause leaves to turn yellow and drop. They are easily disturbed and fly around when you brush against an infested plant. They are often found on hibiscus and ivy. Controls. White flies are attracted to the color yellow, so you can trap them by hanging yellow cards coated with a sticky substance, such as Vaseline, around your plants, or suck them up with a vacuum cleaner as you shake your plants. In serious cases, spray plants with insecticidal soap, neem oil, or horticultural oil. In houses with many plants, consider releasing the whitefly parasite. This miniature wasp kills whitefly larvae but doesn't harm plants, pets, or people. And now, From Carrots Love Tomatoes and Roses Love Garlic by Louise Riote. Here are some companion flowers. Companion planting is not a form of magic. It is simple and practical, making use of known factors in planting a flower or vegetable garden. Companion plantings of some kind have been practices throughout most of agricultural history. Early settlers from Europe found the Native Americans planting corn and pumpkins together. In Holland, in the 1800s, a border of hemp, cannabis, was often planted around a cabbage field to keep away the white cabbage butterflies. Nature herself grows many different kinds of plants successfully as companions. Furthermore, her plants, in most instances, grow very closely together. Instead of isolating particular kinds or varieties, she often places them shoulder to shoulder. Thus, they become a source of needed shade, a climbing support, or a provider of mulch and soil conditioning food. They may even repel other plants, preventing a sturdy, too aggressive species from completely taking over. Legumes, such as clover and alfalfa, have often been used as companion crops by farmers who have grown them to add nitrogen to the soil. The nitrogen fixed by legumes and other plants is not immediately available to neighboring plants, but is released when the legume, or a portion of it, dies and becomes incorporated in the soil. In the flower garden, lupines and other plants belonging to the bean family perform the same function. Some companion plants offer mechanical benefits. Roots of large plants may break up the soil for smaller ones and make root penetration easier, especially in tight soil. Deep tap roots of dandelions and other plants bring up minerals and make them available to plants growing nearer the surface. Large plants, hollyhocks, sunflowers, may provide shade, wind protection, or higher humidity for small plants near them. In nature, shrubs growing around the trunk of a tree may protect it from animals. At the same time, the tree, because of the shade it provides, protects the shrubs from being overwhelmed by weeds. Another key to companion planting is controlled competition. A gardener growing a perennial flower border is engaging in one of the most complex forms of companion planting. The garden is designed not only for color, texture, height, and bloom sequence, but also for controlled competition through proper spacing and varying heights. Some smaller plants are protected by larger ones, but thought must also be given to the aggressive plants that will crowd out slower-growing ones if they are not kept within bounds. We have also learned that it is unwise to plant together those plants that are susceptible to the same insects and diseases. Columbines, which are very attractive to red spiders, should not be planted near other flowers or tomatoes that the spider might also find tasty. We know, too, certain trees exude toxic substances through their roots to inhibit germination of their own seedlings beneath them. This is their natural way to reduce or eliminate competition. On the other hand, the root exudates of dahlias are helpful against certain kinds of nematodes, and they are protective to other flowers against nearby. Many rock garden plants also could be considered companions because they all do well in somewhat dry, sunny sites. Environmental factors make these plants companions. Pumpkins and corn, as the Indians knew, grow well together because they are suited to the same conditions, and their growing rates let them compete favorably for light, water, and nutrients. Plants that like the same growing conditions but occupy different soil strata make good companions. African marigolds and narcissus, for example, and the marigolds also repel certain nematodes that attack the bulbs. We find many other unusual examples of togetherness. Hawkweed, or Indian paintbrush, a beautiful flower and a great attractant for hummingbirds, will not grow from seed unless another plant is sown in the same pot with its seeds. The usual practice is to use blue gramma. Now from Breeders' Digest, 1001 Hints and Tips for Your Garden. Here's some information on primroses, commonly called. Most primula species are called primrose, but this genus also includes the buttercup, oxlip, polyanthus, and cowslip. Primroses are usually listed in catalogs simply by the common species name, such as Japanese or English, while the polyanthus and pruhonesensis hybrids include many named cultivars. What they like. Primroses prefer partial shade and cannot tolerate full sun in summer. They also need a cool spring, a mild summer, and consistently moist soil. Happy marriages. Early flowering polyanthus primroses make fine companions for delicate spring flowers such as for forget-me-nots and narcissus. The moisture-loving candelabra primrose, which flowers later, will look its best with ferns or astilbes or as an underplanting for rhododendrons. Mixed blessings. Planting different strains of polyanthus primroses close together will result in seedlings of different colors next year. They hybridize easily. Although the new plants will bear little resemblance to their parents, they will still be attractive. A rock garden favorite. The drumstick or Himalayan primrose has round clusters of half-inch lavender, purple, or white blossoms, and is the first primrose to bloom in the spring. It performs best when planted in the moist spaces between rocks, where the roots will remain cool. 2. For wildflower gardens, if you live in a temperate region and can grow a deciduous woodland meadow, add English primroses and cowslips. Both are charmers in this setting and bloom in early spring. Colonized candelabras. In damp places, don't rush to remove the spent flowers of candelabra primroses. Left alone to set and spread their seed, they will colonize. In a few years, you will have a collection of pink, crimson, and white flowers. A disappearing act. Don't be disappointed if the Japanese star primrose disappears in the summer. The plant dies down to avoid summer's heat, but will come back the following spring to bloom again. It is particularly lovely in dappled shade. Taking cuttings. Old primroses with rhizomatous roots can be propagated by cutting off portions of the rhizomes in 2-inch lengths. Lay the cuttings horizontally in a box filled with peat and sand, covering them with the mixture about 3/8 inch deep. Keep them in a cold frame during winter. New plants will flower in the following season. If you have patience, try starting different types from seed. Sow them in fall in pots or small feed flats and overwinter in a cold frame. Keep in mind, fresh seed germinates more readily than old seed. We've run out of time for today's episode of Out in the Garden. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Cindy Fowler, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have comments or questions, call 919-833-8255.